Welcome back to another deep dive. We're really glad you're here with us today.
Yeah, so glad you're joining us.
If you're a fellow member of Harmony Christian Church, you probably already know the mission today. We are breaking down Pastor Kent Wagner's latest
From
message.
the Mastering the Kingdom series.
Right, exactly. Specifically his blueprint for financial faithfulness. And our goal here is pretty simple. We really want to extract the core insights, the stories and the practical takeaways from the sermon.
So that you are fully armed and ready to bring the heat to your Connect group this week.
Yes, to lead a really fantastic discussion because it's, well, money is a heavy topic to
Well,
tackle.
for sure. Money usually makes people tense up immediately.
Right.
Like, especially in a church setting, right?
Yeah.
People cross their arms.
Yeah. Walls go up instantly.
They do. But what stood out right away was how Pastor Kent intentionally disarmed the room before he even really got into the material. He established some very firm ground rules.
He did, which I think was super necessary.
Absolutely. He stated clearly that this is about spiritual growth, not some fundraising tactic. He openly welcomed the skeptics, and he reminded everyone that he doesn't know what anyone in the congregation gives.
Right, which is completely by design.
Exactly. He doesn't set his own salary,
Yeah.
and he promised there were no manipulative pledge cards coming at the end of the service.
Giving people permission to just sit and listen without like an imminent sales pitch hanging over their heads, it really lowers the temperature in the room.
It definitely did.
And once those defenses were down, he opened with this analogy that I think basically every parent in the congregation felt in their bones.
Oh, yeah, the hospital video.
Yes, he talked about how bringing a baby home from the hospital is utterly terrifying because they just hand you a human life with zero instructions.
Nothing. Good luck.
Right. Back when he and Jenny were living in Kansas, he said the hospital wheeled in this old tube TV with a glitchy VHS tape. And the entire takeaway from the video was basically,
Don't shake the baby.
don't shake the baby, no diaper tutorials, no feeding schedules, just the absolute baseline guardrail of what not to do.
Which is such a funny image, but it serves as a great roadmap for how he actually structured the whole message.
Oh, so.
Well, you have the theological framework first. That's the don't shake the baby part, the foundational non-negotiable rules. And then you have the practical day-to-day playbook of how to actually manage the resources you've been given.
Okay, let's start with that theological foundation then, because he shared a story from early in his marriage that was honestly almost uncomfortably relatable.
The dishwashing incident.
The dishwashing incident. He and Jenny were in the middle of this massive argument. He was standing at the kitchen sink, aggressively scrubbing a single dish until he was like practically taking the finish off it.
We've all been there.
We really have. And he's having that internal angry prayer session we all do. He's telling God, this is not a big deal. Why can't you just give on this?
And the response he got in that moment is just profound. The Holy Spirit prompted him right back with, if it's not that big of a deal, why can't you give on it?
Ooh.
Right. That is a mirror being held right up to human stubbornness.
I really found myself squirming in my seat a bit when he said that.
Oh, same. But he used that exact psychology to address the tension around tithing. He mentioned that throughout this whole series, he hears a lot of pushback.
Yeah, people saying it's not a big deal.
Exactly. They'll say, Kent, tithing isn't a big deal. We shouldn't even be spending time talking about it. And his counter to that is fascinating. He agrees with them.
He does, which caught me off guard.
He says it actually isn't a big deal. But if it's truly not a big deal, then it should be effortless to do. The sheer amount of energy people expend fighting against the concept of the tithe, it reveals that they are the ones making it a massive deal. It totally exposes where the heart actually is.
Well, and people also try to build a theological defense against it, right? They argue that Jesus never talked about tithing, which Pastor Kemp firmly corrected.
He brought out the receipts.
He really did. He pointed to Matthew 23:23, where Jesus is actively calling out the Pharisees. These religious leaders were so obsessed with the letter of the law that they were taking tiny leaves of mint, dill, and cumin.
Literally measuring out exactly one-tenth of their garden herbs.
Right, tithing their spices. But meanwhile, they were completely ignoring justice, mercy, and faithfulness.
What's fascinating here is the common misinterpretation. People think Jesus was telling them to stop worrying about the tiny leaves and only focus on justice. But if you look at the text, Jesus literally says, you should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former.
He is affirming the tithe.
Yes, he's essentially saying that tithing is the baseline. It's the easy part. You shouldn't neglect that foundational obedience while you focus on the heavier, more complex matters of the heart.
It all really funnels down to that core warning in Matthew 6.24. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money.
That is the ultimate theological guardrail right there. When money becomes the boss of your life, it competes directly with God for your allegiance.
So if that is the baseline theology, how do we actually execute it? Especially when you're sitting there feeling like you have absolutely nothing left to give.
That brings us to the practical playbook.
Yeah, and he used a visual that I think works perfectly for a Connect group discussion. The classic professor analogy with the jar.
Oh, the rocks in the sand.
Yep. If you take a glass jar and fill it with sand, first representing all your random everyday expenses, and then you try to cram the big rocks in at the very end, they simply won't fit. The math doesn't work.
It requires a strict order of operations. You have to put the big rock in first. In this context, the tithe is that first big rock. Then you add the pebbles, which represent your savings. Finally, you pour in the sand, which is your everyday spending. The sand just naturally fills in the gaps around the rocks and pebbles.
But the immediate barrier for most people trying to flip that order is debt. You can want to put the big rock in first, but if Visa and MasterCard are demanding your paycheck every Friday, you feel stuck.
Totally paralyzed.
And Pastor Kent got very vulnerable here about his own past. He and Jenny brought a mountain of debt into their early marriage, student loans, credit cards.
And he even called out his own past purchase of a, what did he call it?
A quote-unquote cool motorcycle.
Right, the cool motorcycle. They were sitting under $30,000 of consumer and student debt.
Which on a young pastor's salary is suffocating.
It is. And their strategy to get out from under it in just 1 year is where we see the difference between typical financial advice and radical financial faithfulness. To clear that amount of debt that fast, they had to make choices that most people would consider completely unacceptable.
Unacceptable is the perfect word. They sold their nice house and moved into a bug-infested double-wide trailer out in the country in Kansas.
Their rent dropped to $250 a month.
The descriptions of this place were wild. He talked about a literal hole in the floor that they just covered up with a paint bucket.
And Jenny standing there with bug spray and a vacuum cleaner, just fighting off lines of ants marching down the walls.
Oh, and he mentioned having a guest over for dinner.
Yes. The guest who took one look at their living room and said, "I think this is the room where they slaughtered the buffalo."
So funny. It paints quite a picture.
Yeah.
But beneath the humor, the sacrifice there is immense. They drastically lowered their standard of living to free up every possible dollar. And where they directed those dollars is crucial. They used the snowball method.
For anyone leading a Connect group, you'll want to make sure your group understands the mechanics of this method. It's often credited to Dave Ramsey. The standard mathematical advice is to pay off the debt with the highest interest rate first. But the snowball method ignores that entirely. You focus exclusively on the lowest debt balance.
Why ignore the interest rate, though? Doesn't that technically cost you more in the long run?
Mathematically, perhaps a little. But debt is rarely a math problem. It's a behavior problem. If you tackle a massive student loan just because it has a high interest rate, you might go months or years without feeling any real sense of progress. You lose motivation.
You just burn out.
Exactly. The snowball method is all about quick wins. You pay the minimums on everything else, and you throw every extra dollar you can scrape together at that smallest debt, even if it's just 20 bucks from skipping coffee.
And when that small debt is gone, you get a psychological boost.
Precisely. And the key is what you do next. You don't take that newly freed up monthly payment and just absorb it back into your lifestyle. You take the entire amount you were paying on debt number one and you roll it into the minimum payment of debt number two.
Right.
As you knock out each balance, the payment you are rolling over grows larger and larger. It snowballs. Eventually, you are dropping massive payments on your largest debts with incredible momentum.
But to fuel that snowball, you have to find extra money in the budget. This is where Pastor Kent fired off a ton of lifestyle hacks. And honestly, this is going to be incredibly fertile ground for your group discussions. Let's look at food first.
Yeah, they use a physical wall calendar.
Right, to plan out every single meal for their family of six. They base their grocery shopping strictly on that calendar. They save up cash to buy beef in bulk. And at times, they've managed to keep their entire family's home food budget under $500 a month.
That requires fierce intentionality.
It really does.
It also extends to how they approach their marriage. When they were living on that single salary with four kids under the age of four, they couldn't afford expensive date nights. The cultural expectation is that romance requires spending $100 at a nice restaurant. They totally rejected that.
They had shopping dates. They would load all four kids into a cart at Sam's Club, buy a $1.75 slice of pizza to split, and just walk the aisles spending time together. It's a great reminder that your spouse's feeling of being loved isn't tied to the price tag of the date.
The cultural pressure is a huge theme here. He tackled tech and entertainment with the same countercultural logic, buying older used phones, like an iPhone 12, instead of upgrading to the 17.
Using a $25 Align service like Google Fi.
Yes. They cut all their streaming services. Yeah. No Netflix. Mm-hmm. They went back to borrowing DVDs from the library, which his kids call DIBDs.
They loved that part. And the TV antenna. Just plugging a cheap antenna into a high-def TV to get 32 channels for free. It's funny how we forget that broadcast television still exists.
We get so conditioned to recurring subscription models that we forget they're all alternative. The same goes for vehicles. He urged the congregation to stop buying brand new cars just to project an image.
He drives a paid-off 2011 Dodge Ram. Yes, it might use more gas, but it has zero monthly payment. Stepping off that consumer treadmill is a massive step toward financial freedom.
For sure.
Now, beyond just cutting expenses, Pastor Kent shared a non-negotiable rule regarding marriage and money. He called it the no roommates rule.
This is a big one.
He insists that there is no his money and hers money in a marriage. It all goes into one pot.
This is a point where a lot of modern couples might feel some friction. The trend right now is often to maintain separate accounts to retain independence or to avoid arguing about spending habits.
I can totally hear people in a connect group saying, but isn't it just safer to keep things separate? If we have our own money, we don't fight about who bought what.
It might avoid short-term arguments, but Pastor Ken's point is that keeping finances separate treats the marriage like a roommate agreement. It creates an escape hatch.
Wow, an escape hatch.
Yeah. When you pool all your resources, it forces you to have difficult, sometimes conflict-heavy conversations about your unified priorities. What do WE value? Where are WU going? Those hard conversations are the forge where unity is actually built. Avoiding the fight often means avoiding the intimacy that comes from working through it together.
That makes a lot of sense. So once the money is pooled, how do you manage it without driving each other crazy? He walked us through their automated bucket system, and I think the behavioral psychology behind this is brilliant.
Automation is key here.
Right. They have all their income hit one central bill account. From there, the money is automatically transferred into separate specific buckets. You are taking the decision-making process out of the moment of temptation.
Exactly. So a set amount auto-transfers to an eating-out account. When that debit card declines or hits zero, the fun is over. It's mac and cheese at home until the first of the month.
Money auto-transfers to a grocery account, which forces them to prioritize feeding the family over an impulse buy at Lululemon. But the most interesting part to me was their big expense savings account.
The offshore account.
Yes. He uses an online bank that intentionally takes 3 full days to transfer funds back to his main checking account.
This is a textbook behavioral economic strategy. We live in a world designed to remove all friction from purchasing. Apple Pay, Amazon One Click. They want the time between you seeing an item and buying it to be thorough seconds.
It's way too easy.
By putting their large savings in an account that takes 72 hours to clear, they are artificially reintroducing friction. It gives the logical, rational part of the brain time to catch up the emotional, impulsive part. If you still want the item 3 days later, maybe it's a valid purchase. But most of the time, the urge just passes.
It's a perfect example of building systems that protect you from yourself. You make your money work for you rather than working to serve your impulses. But let's pause there because we need to get to the ultimate why behind all of this. Why live in a bug-infested trailer? Why eat mac and cheese?
Why drive a 15-year-old truck and endure 3-day bank transfers?
Exactly. If the goal is just to have a big savings account, it becomes its own kind of idolatry.
Pastor Kent brought the whole message to a really powerful turning point here. He said he realized years ago that he was so busy funding the kingdoms of MasterCard and Visa that he had nothing left to fund the kingdom of God.
That's the entire point. Getting out of debt isn't just about personal peace. It's about freeing up resources for kingdom impact.
To illustrate this, he shared a story about a friend of his who is extremely wealthy. The kind of wealth where you casually debate the logistics of buying a private jet.
Right. And because Kent and Jenny were faithful tithers, even when they were dirt poor, God provided for them through this specific friend. On 2 separate occasions, this friend just bought them a car when they needed one.
What Pastor Kent noted about that relationship is so important. He said he has never met a truly wealthy Christian who wasn't also fiercely generous. People who successfully navigate wealth without it destroying them have mastered the principle that money is a tool, not a master.
Which sets up what is arguably the most confusing part of the sermon, Jesus's parable of the shrewd manager in Luke chapter 16. I have to admit, every time I read this parable, I scratch my head.
It's a tough one.
You have a manager who is about to get fired for wasting his boss's money. So he goes around to everyone who owes his boss a debt, and he aggressively slashes what they owe. He does this entirely to curry favor, hoping these people will take care of him once he's out of a job.
It's literally a story about a white-collar criminal committing fraud to save his own skin.
Exactly. You expect the punchline of the story to be Jesus dropping the hammer on this guy. Instead, the boss actually commends the dishonest manager for acting shrewdly. And Jesus follows it up with this shocking piece of advice. He says, "Use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings."
It sounds incredibly unbiblical on the surface.
Jesus is telling us to use money to buy friends. How do we unpack that for a connect group?
It does sound crazy, but Jesus is using a jarring story to make a brilliant point about eternal return on investment. The shrewd manager realized that his current resources, his access to his master's wealth, were temporary. He was about to lose his position, so he used the temporary resources he had right now to secure his future reality.
Okay, so applying that to us.
Jesus is saying that your money, your worldly wealth, is temporary. You are only managing it for a brief window of time on earth. Eventually, it will be gone. You will die, and you can't take a dime of it with you.
Right.
So while you have it, be as shrewd as that manager. Use that temporary wealth to impact people. Use it to fund ministries, to help the poor, to advance the gospel. You are buying friends in the sense that you're investing in the eternal destinies of human beings.
So that when you enter eternity, you are welcomed by the very people whose lives were changed because of how you deployed your resources.
That is the eternal dwelling. The so what here is a fundamental shift in identity. You're meant to be a conduit, not a bucket.
I love that visual.
A bucket hoards water. It holds onto it until the water eventually goes stagnant. A conduit is just a pipe. It allows the water to flow through it to nourish the fields and communities around it. Your money is meant to flow through you.
If you're leading a Connect group this week, a great question to ask your group is simply, where is the water stagnating in your life right now, and where is it flowing? It's a gentle way to evaluate if we are acting like buckets or conduits.
That's a fantastic discussion prompt.
Yeah.
Because it moves the conversation from the math of budgeting into the theology of the heart.
Well, if you are listening to this right now, you have the full picture. You have the theological, don't shake the baby framework.
Yeah.
And you have the granular, practical playbook of snowballing debt and automating your buckets. You are equipped to lead a really challenging, honest, and fruitful conversation with your Harmony Connect group this week.
And as you prepare for that meeting, we want to leave you with one final thought to ponder. Pastor Kent asked the congregation what they want to hear when they enter eternity. But let's bring that audit into the present moment. Imagine if a forensic accountant, a complete stranger, were to look exclusively at your bank statements from the last 3 months. They know absolutely nothing else about you. They don't know your intentions. They don't know your heart. They don't know what you sing on Sunday mornings. They only have the math.
Wow.
Based purely on where your money flows, what would that stranger conclude is the absolute most important master in your life?
That's a tough mirror to look into, but it's exactly the question we need to be wrestling with. Have an amazing time at your Connect groups this week, everybody. We'll see you next time.